Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. As migrants tried to avoid Hungary's closed borders, Serbia shuttled them in buses towards Croatia. A small Serbian border village became their last stop in Serbia. VOA's Aisha Tanzim reports from Bezdan.
A steady stream of migrants are arriving on buses and taxis in the Serbian border village of Bezdan, which is only 1 kilometer away from the Croatian border. Here they're receiving help from the Red Cross. The Serbian Red Cross has set up a table here. Families are receiving aid, mostly women and children. You can see the relief on people's faces after a long journey. They seem welcome in Serbia. We heard a woman say, "Thank you, Serbia." She went up to the police officer and said, "Thank you, Serbia." We had a family pose for photographs. We have people smiling. They feel like they have gone through a lot, and now it seems a relief to them that a country is helping them go through with aid supplies. So from here, these migrants will walk 1 kilometer to the border of Croatia. Aisha Tanzim, VOA News, Bezdan.
Babar Balak is a UN High Commission for Refugees spokesman. He had this to say.
We have responded to humanitarian emergencies within hours. Within 3 days, we can put in place mechanisms for refugee arrivals, registration, up to 5.5 million people or 750,000 people. We can empty our warehouses in Dubai, Copenhagen, and other places. We know how to do the job, but the responsibility, the moral and legal responsibility here is on the countries in the European Union.
If you would like more information on this story, please visit our website at voanews.com. The United States says it is considering direct talks with Russia in the midst of growing concerns about the Russian military buildup in Syria and the Kremlin's professed willingness to send combat units to the war-torn Middle East nation. Secretary of State John Kerry said President Barack Obama believes such discussions with Moscow are important as the U.S. and its allies seek to resolve the worsening crisis in Syria and the flood of refugees from that civil war now flooding Europe. Russia is one of Assad's staunchest allies. A group of Taliban militants attacked an Air Force base in northwestern Pakistan early Friday, killing at least 29 people and wounding many others. Military spokesperson Major General Asim Bajaw told reporters that militants wearing paramilitary forces uniforms entered the residential compound of the Badhabar Air Base near Peshawar in two groups. One of the groups stormed a mosque where base staff were offering early morning prayers, he said, adding that the attack left 16 worshippers dead. The other group of militants attacked another area of the compound, killing several other people. Bajwa said a quick reaction force reached the base and engaged the attackers, killing 13 of the militants. A U.S. diplomat says efforts are underway to convince Burkina Faso group coup leaders to restore the transitional government and let the country proceed with elections. U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs Linda Thomas-Greenfield gave an exclusive interview to VOA's Miriama Diallo-Crandall in Washington Friday. Thomas-Greenfield said there was no reason for the soldiers behind Wednesday's coup to seize power and arrest the legally recognized government of Burkina Faso. Thomas-Greenfield said the U.S. ambassador in Burkina Faso and other officials have talked with the coup leaders who come from the presidential guard of former Burkinabe President Blaise Compaoré. A U.S. diplomat says his country and Cuba have a historic opportunity to work together to provide medical care for Haiti, still struggling to recover from a devastating 2010 earthquake that killed more than 200,000 people. Brian Chacon, Deputy Chief of Mission at the U.S. Embassy in Port-au-Prince, said Thursday that following the reestablishment of diplomatic ties between the U.S. and Cuba, the doctors of both countries could work together to help improve Haiti's dilapidated healthcare system. And global stock markets are responding cautiously Friday to the U.S. Federal Reserve's decision to hold off on raising interest rates. In a long-awaited announcement Thursday, the U.S. Central Bank decided to keep interest rates unchanged at the record low rate they have been at for several years. The Fed is still widely expected to raise rates before the end of the year. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Ethiopia knows its threats to security, and you cannot sleep and kind of forget that there is a threat coming from Eritrea, there's a threat coming from Somalia, there's a threat coming from maybe South Sudan.
That's independent analyst Sunde Okello explaining why Ethiopia has so far not experienced Al-Shabaab attacks on its soil. Details coming up.
Also in the news, the UN Children's Agency says more than 500,000 children have been forced from their homes during the last 6 months of an insurgency by Boko Haram militants in northeastern Nigeria. And Cameroon disputes accusations by Amnesty International that its military commits atrocities as it fights Boko Haram terrorism.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Uganda, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, coup leaders in Burkina Faso say they have released the country's ousted president, Michel Kafando, after holding him for 2 days. But they have not commented on the status of the prime minister, who was also detained. The coup leaders released a statement today saying they have released Kafando and two government ministers they had been holding as a sign of easing tensions and in general interest. They gave no details about Prime Minister Isaac Zida, who was taken into custody along with the president on Wednesday. Brigadier General Gilbert Diendere, head of the country's new ruling council, spoke to VOA's French to Africa service yesterday, a day after soldiers overthrew the West African country's transitional government and arrested its leaders. The general said soldiers staged the coup because the country's political process was biased. He said he will start a political dialogue to include all parties. Burkina Faso was scheduled to hold parliamentary and presidential elections on October 11th. That date is now in limbo. The White House said yesterday that it condemns in the strongest terms the unconstitutional seizure of power in Burkina Faso. It called for the president and prime minister to be released immediately, for the coup leaders to stand down, for them to respect the rights of citizens to assemble peacefully, and for Burkina Faso to be put back on the road to October's presidential elections.
When armed presidential guards upended the democratic process in Burkina Faso, they placed a former president's chief military advisor in command. Paul Mellet of Cathram House in London says there are many reasons why the soldiers performed a coup 2 days ago, but strong regional pressure from the nation's neighbors could persuade General Gilbert Diendere to step down and let democracy take its course. Paul Mellet spoke with VOA's David Arnold in Washington, D.C.
The reason that they took him into custody is part of the main driving force, if you like, behind the coup, when essentially people who were loyal to the former president, Blaise Compaoré, who had been overthrown in a people power revolution a year ago, essentially tried to take control of the transition process that is supposed to lead to elections in October. They were not satisfied with the terms on which those elections were being organized by Michel Kafando and his prime minister, Isaac Zida. And so they arrested both men and other ministers. However, the reason they released Kafando, or at least released him into house arrest, which according to the latest reports is one possibility, it's not exactly clear what's happened, appears already to result from international pressure. The reaction of the international community, and more particularly the reaction of West African neighbors and Africa as a whole, was complete and total condemnation without any reservation of the coup, because all of the justifications, all of the grievances advanced by the putschists were things that could have been discussed or negotiated and were seen as no justification at all for overthrowing a peaceful transition to full democracy.
It has been suggested that the Kafando presidency overstepped their bounds when they limited the participation of members of the Compaoré's political party and the Presidential Guard from elections.
That may or may not be true, in depending on whether you think their action was justified, because Compaoré had been in power for more than two decades and had built up a very powerful base, particularly in the presidential security regiment and in his political machine, so that even in elections over recent years, the outcome was always a completely foregone conclusion. Defenders of the actions of the transitional administration would say that it was only by imposing those constraints that they could ensure a genuinely fair and open and fresh democratic contest. But of course, defenders of the Compaoré camp would argue that in a real democracy, you have to allow all sides to participate. And there is, if you like, precedence in the region to support either argument. And if you like, the pro-Compaoré camp have some arguments on their side. But I think the way that wider campaigners for democracy in Burkina Faso see it, and the way certainly that ECOWAS, the West African regional bloc of countries, and the wider African and international community sees it, is that these are secondary questions of process. Fundamentally, if you want to change the political rules in West Africa today, it is expected that you will only do it through peaceful negotiation and not the use of force. The guy, Diendere, the military advisor to Compaoré, who is now at the head of the junta, it's not quite clear whether he organized the coup or was sort of put forward to front for it after it had happened. He's a very senior figure who will be well aware of this kind of international context. And one gets the impression that we're now in the middle of a sort of negotiation where he's been confronted with the scale of the pressure that could be applied. So it's possible that the whole putsch could sort of collapse or wind down by negotiated means over the next hours or days. If over this weekend some sort of face-saving deal is negotiated that allows them to climb down and means that the transitional authorities are restored, then it may be that the elections, so there would still be time to have them on the 11th.
Did the Presidential Guard or whoever's responsible conduct this coup to put forward a better democratic process, or are they possibly trying to return the former president to office?
Certainly some members of the Presidential Guard may be hoping to return the former president, Compaoré, to office. He was in exile in Morocco. He's just gone to Congo-Brazzaville in the last few days, it's reported. But whether the leaders of the coup and whether General Diendere, who's now fronting the junta, think that's a realistic prospect, seems less likely, because at a senior level, people know that West Africa and the world has changed. And more than in other parts of the African continent, ECOWAS is a bloc that is very strongly, firmly committed to constitutional democratic rule.
That was Paul Malay, an associate fellow at the Chatham House Africa program, talking to VOA's David Arnold.
Well, over the past 5 years, Somali militant groups have carried out bombings in most of the countries around the Horn of Africa, except for Ethiopia. From Addis Ababa, Marta Vanderwerf reports on why Ethiopia has been able to avoid attacks.
Kenya, Uganda, Djibouti, the self-declared Republic of Somaliland, they have all been attacked by the Somali militant group Al-Shabaab. But Ethiopia, which invaded Somalia in 2006 to fight Al-Shabaab, has so far never experienced a large-scale attack. Tewolde Mulugeta of Ethiopia's Ministry of Foreign Affairs says Ethiopia has been successful in preventing attacks by involving the general public.
We know what lack of peace means. So the importance is well understood by our people. So, I mean, whenever they are going to come across any anti-peace element, any anti-peace force, any terrorist force, they are going to expose them, they are going to fight them head on.
It is not clear how many potential attacks Ethiopian security forces have prevented. A bomb exploded inside a house in central Addis Ababa in 2013. It is believed the attackers were preparing it for a large football match that was taking place that day. Ethiopia's military is considered to have one of the stronger military forces in the region. Sunday Okello is an independent peace and security expert. He explains that Ethiopian security forces are strong because Al-Shabaab is not the only threat to the country.
Ethiopia knows its threat to security, and you cannot sleep and kind of forget that there is a threat coming from Eritrea, there's a threat coming from Somalia, there's a threat coming from maybe South Sudan. And to that effect, I think Ethiopia has managed to build its security network very strongly.
The most famous terror attack by Al-Shabaab will be remembered this week. 2 years ago, gunmen stormed the Westgate Mall in Kenya's capital and killed 67 people. Another large attack took place in April, when terrorists killed 148 students at a Kenyan university. Abebe Mulene is the director of the security sector program at the East African bloc IGAD. He says there are several reasons why Al-Shabaab attacks Kenya so frequently, including the fact it has a Kenyan affiliate, Al-Hajira.
Besides to this, the movement of the Al-Shabaab group, particularly in the coastal area, it is an open ground for them to incubate and to organize their attack in Kenya. Apart from this, there is also a high level of corruption with security institutions there.
Ethiopian forces continue to fight Al-Shabaab in Somalia, working in conjunction with African Union troops. The AU troops have made significant gains, but the militant group remains one of the biggest security threats to the East African region. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehiz Wahib, 18 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Coup leaders in Burkina Faso say they have released the country's ousted president, Michel Kafando, after holding him for 2 days. And the UN Children's Agency says more than 500,000 children have been forced from their homes during the last 6 months of an insurgency by Boko Haram militants in northeastern Nigeria. And would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at African News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
In news of Europe's migrant crisis, Croatian Prime Minister Zoran Milanovic said that his country cannot and will not close its borders, but will redirect migrants to Hungary. Milanovic said that Croatia will no longer register the thousands of migrants entering the country after more than 11,000 crossed into Croatia this week. Croatia sealed 7 of its 8 border crossings with Serbia late yesterday after a surge of migrants crossed into the country and Hungary turned them away. In an interview on Croatian television today, Milanovic said Croatia is a small country, and while migrants are welcome to pass through, the nation cannot house them all. He said they will get food, water, and medical help, but must keep traveling. Milanovic promised he will not send government troops to the border, calling the move both unconstitutional and impossible. A spokesman for the UN Nations High Commission for Refugees, or UNHCR, said today that the EU needs to take collective action in the face of the migrant and refugee crisis. Babar Baluch said that although the UNHCR can help, the moral and legal responsibility to deal with the current migrant situation rests with countries in Europe.
Also Friday, Germany's foreign minister said if some European Union members continue to be reluctant to agree to a quota system for accepting refugees, they may have to be overruled by the other members. Frank-Walter Settenmeier told a German newspaper today that Europe should consider the use of a qualified majority vote next week at a meeting of EU foreign ministers to discuss the refugee situation. The 28-member EU normally tries to reach a consensus on important issues. Stenmeier said Germany, Austria, Sweden and Italy cannot carry the burden of hosting Europe's current flood of refugees alone. Four Eastern European countries, Hungary, the Czech Republic, Slovakia and Poland, have said they will not comply with the quota plan Stenmeier is trying to push through. A meeting of EU interior ministers last Monday failed to reach consensus on the plan, although the European Parliament approved the measure later in the week.
As France begins welcoming its first batch of Iraqis and Syrians out of 24,000 due to be resettled from elsewhere in Europe, questions are mounting over the status and treatment of longer-term migrants out of the media spotlight. Many of them are sleeping in the street as the country scrambles to find new housing. Lisa Bryant reports from Paris.
A tent camp by the Seine River in downtown Paris. This is the other face of Europe's migrant crisis. But the Africans who found shelter here are leaving. Paris authorities evacuated two squatter sites this week, including this one. 18-year-old Ahmed from Sudan is leaving the only home he knows in France.
They told us, they took people from here to residence, but we don't know what is the residence.
Across town, several hundred migrants are occupying an abandoned high school. Afghan Nasrullah Dalatsai had been sleeping in the streets for months until he came here.
It's great, it's nice, better than when people are sleeping outside. It's very nice, you know, happy.
France's newest influx of asylum seekers, Iraqis and Syrians, are getting very different treatment. All have housing, and they've been issued temporary papers. Authorities are now scrambling to find more space to shelter thousands more expected in the coming months. Activist Alvé Ouzan says many of the migrants occupying the high school are also political refugees.
Ça veut dire, on dit, ah, c'est vrai.
Ouzan claims French authorities are establishing quotas for Syrians and Iraqis because they come from conflict-torn countries. But they don't talk about quotas for Sudanese or Eritreans like those living here. He is shocked by that. Matthias Fischera, cabinet director for Paris Mayor Anne Hidalgo, was at hand for the tent camp eviction.
Là, effectivement, nous, ce que l'on souhaite au niveau de la ville, c'est que tout le monde puisse être traité. Mais effectivement,
Fischera says the city wants to treat the cases of all migrants and asylum seekers, but there are priority lines depending on each situation. Paris City Hall is opening up new migrant shelters. Those from the tent camp will get temporary housing while their situations are reviewed. Like Ahmed, they face an uncertain future. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
For European policymakers, the influx of refugees to Europe has been a logistical challenge. But some observers say the migrants are a blessing in disguise. That's because they may help to replenish the population of an aging continent. Once employed, the newcomers will pay taxes into state health and pension systems. Marley Morris is a researcher at the Institute for Public Policy Research in London. Reporter Jeffrey Young asked him to explain his optimistic view of the migrants.
Yeah, no, I think there's a good case to be made for that. I think if you look at countries like Germany, like Spain, they are aging populations, they are shrinking populations, and they really do need migrants in order to sustain their economies for the coming years. So in many ways, you know, these countries do need these migrants. And I think that's partly why some countries like Germany are being quite welcoming in their attitude to the refugees that are arriving there.
We've heard for decades that as they get older, there's not enough replenishment. The birth rate has been so low that there's really not enough people growing up and becoming part of the society to do the jobs and also to pay into the healthcare system and pay into the pension system. And this influx of migrants or refugees actually addresses that, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the two things that, you know, affect population growth are, you know, birth rates, death rates, and net migration. And so, you know, if you can't control the birth and death rates, then the best way to control the population growth and the shape and kind of age structure of that population is through migration. And, you know, a number of the migrants that are coming over to Europe are young, you know, they are entrepreneurial, they are hardworking, and they'll be able to pay into that tax system in order to really replenish you know, European economies.
And also the skill set. As you just mentioned, a lot of them do have a certain degree of education. They have real skills that belong in the marketplace, correct?
Oh, no, absolutely. That's true. You know, there are a number of graduates coming over, and there are a number of people who have middle skill sets that are really what many of these countries like Germany need in their labor market. So, you know, as long as the labor markets are able to integrate in these newcomers into their societies, then they will be able to help to sustain their economies.
Let's focus on the integration part. What do countries need to do as these refugees arrive on their borders and come into their countries? How do they bring them into the workplace, and how do they make them productive?
Well, I think the number one barrier to integration into the labor market is language, and, you know, in particular, being able to have the right language skills in order to ensure that migrants are able to work, are able to, you know, be able to be integrated into their communities. And, you know, the other key element is making sure that they have networks in their society. And many of these refugees won't, you know, necessarily have huge numbers of contacts. The migrant communities from Syria, you know, are relatively newly established. So they'll need to be able to really, you know, find networks with other communities in order to build those connections, in order to get into the labor market, in order to, you know, make contacts and networks throughout local communities across Europe.
That was a researcher at the Institute for Public Policy Research in London, Marley Morris. He was speaking with reporter Jeffrey Young.
The UN Children's Agency says more than 500,000 children have been forced from their homes during the last 6 months of an insurgency by Boko Haram militants in northeastern Nigeria. UNICEF officials have issued a statement that the number represents a sharp rise in attacks by the jihadists. The UN officials say more than 1.4 million children have fled attacks by Boko Haram in Nigeria and in neighboring countries in recent years. The UN agency states in northern Nigeria alone, nearly 1.2 million children, over half of them under 5 years old, have been forced to flee their homes. An additional 265,000 children have been uprooted in Cameroon, Chad, and Niger. Former Nigerian general and one-time military ruler Muhammadu Buhari was elected 3 months ago and pledged renewed regional efforts to end Boko Haram's terrorist activities.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Yiswuhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Your ears on Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best Pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC. Every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best right here on VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Coup leaders in Burkina Faso say they have released the country's ousted president, Michel Kafando, after holding him for 2 days. And the UN Children's Agency says more than 500,000 children have been forced from their homes during the last 6 months of an insurgency by Boko Haram militants in northeastern Nigeria. Coming up, we'll have music from Uganda, and in our feature segment, the International Monetary Fund and other creditors refuse to cancel Zimbabwe's $10 billion debt. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehias Ruhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. It's time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. Happy Friday, Sunny.
Happy Friday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you have some All-Africa Games kudos.
Kim, here's a sunny side of sports salute to Egypt, which has clinched the overall All-Africa Games medal title in Congo, Brazzaville. Heading into Friday's action, the Egyptian team had an unbeatable 193 medals, including 76 gold. Athletics action wrapped up Thursday at the new Kintele Stadium in Brazzaville. Marco Uma reports.
Eritrean world record holder Zerzene Tadesa won men's half marathon on the last day of the athletics competition on Thursday. Ethiopian Mamitu Daska triumphed in the women's race. On the track, Aureol Dongmo won women's shot put in a Cameroon national record of 17.21 meters. Ivory Coast's Kofi Wilfred Hua and Marie-Jose Talou won men's and women's 200 meters respectively. Egypt's Ehab Abdelrahman El Sayed and Botswana's Kabelo Hosimang triumphed in men's javelin and high jump, respectively. Ethiopians Getane Mola and Dawit Seyaum prevailed in men's 5,000 meters and women's 1,500 meters, respectively. Nigeria bagged gold medals through men's long jumper Samson Idiata, Amaka Ogoegbonam in women's 400-meter hurdles and the women's 4x400-meter relay. Kenya set a men's 4x400-meter relay championship record of 3 minutes and 0.34 seconds. The old mark of 3 minutes and 0.55 seconds was run by Nigeria in Nairobi, Kenya in 1987. I'm Mark Ouma, wishing you all a sporty weekend.
Thanks, Mark, and wishing you a sporty weekend, too. Our African football guru, David Legg, joins us again this evening for a look at recent African goal-scoring highlights in Europe.
Yes, Sonny, and I'm pleased to report plenty of goals. It's always nice to see African scorers in the English Premier League. The English Premier League is the most followed league in Africa. It seems whether you're in Nairobi, whether you're in Accra, whether you're in Lagos, Abuja, Dar es Salaam, wherever you are, Sonny, one of the first questions people ask you is, who do you support in the English Premier League? I'm still supporting Liverpool, Sonny, but they're testing me a lot these days with some of their performances. Anyway, Manchester City, I'm proud to say, Kelechi Iheanacho. He's a Nigerian. He came on very late in the game, but just 60 seconds after he arrived on the pitch, he scored a goal that gave City a 1-0 victory at Crystal Palace. Well done for him. And completing a great weekend for Nigerians in England, Odion Ighalo, he scored for Watford, and that proved to be also the match winner. 1-0 victory for Watford over Swansea City. Now, Swansea had made a great start to the season, unbeaten after 4 matches. They held Chelsea in London. They beat Manchester United at home. So well done, Watford, a promoted club. And it was Ighalo's goal that inflicted on Swansea their first defeat of the season. Riyad Mahrez is another person we've mentioned a lot recently on the sunny side of sport. He's French-born, but he plays for Algeria because his parents come from the North African country. And he's with Leicester City, who've made a great start. And they, last weekend, made a superb comeback. 2 goals down at home to Aston Villa. They came back to win 3-2. Mahrez did not score, but he assisted in all 3 goals. And that, to me, is almost as important as scoring. It's nice to be able to create goals as well. And not forgetting, in his first 3 matches, Mahrez scored 4 goals for Leicester City, who are known as the Foxes. And that's quite interesting, Sonny, because he, of course, plays for Algeria, and they're known as the Desert Foxes. In Spain, Cedric Bakumba, who is from the Democratic Republic of Congo, he scored for Villarreal in a 3-1 victory at Granada. No African goals in Italy, but some in France. Majid Waris, he's a Ghanaian international, he scored for Lorient. And although he didn't score any goals, Vincent Nyema, the veteran Nigeria goalkeeper, he was outstanding for Lille in preventing goals being scored by Lyon. Because of the great performance of Nyema, Lille were able to force a 0-0 draw at Lyon. And Lille, Sonny, are now coached by none other than Hervé Renard. He is the only coach to have guided two different countries to the Africa Cup of Nations title. 2012, he caused a sensation when he guided Zambia to victory over Ivory Coast. And much more recently, this year, in fact, he guided Ivory Coast to victory over Ghana. Both, incidentally, after penalty shootouts. Goals and Germany, and you think immediately of Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, the Gabonese striker and runner-up in the most recent African Footballer of the Year poll behind Yaya Toure of Ivory Coast. Now, Aubameyang has been on fire in the Bundesliga. He scored a brace against Hanover, both from the penalty spot, and he has now managed 5 goals, which is just one less than the leading scorer, Thomas Müller of Bayern Munich. And another African scorer in Germany was Anthony Ucha. He's a Nigerian, and he scored for Werder Bremen in a 3-1 win over Hoffenheim. So no doubt, Sonny, in the past weekend, lots of African sharpshooters in Europe coming from Nigeria. So congratulations to them. And that's a real boost for Sunday Elise. He needs some sharpshooters because in their most recent Cup of Nations game, they failed to score in Tanzania, a 0-0 draw, and are now trailing Egypt by 2 points in the group of death.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa. Undefeated American boxing star Floyd Mayweather recently announced his retirement after a unanimous decision victory over Andre Berto. I asked our reigning prince of pugilistics, Namdi Hollywood Moweta, do you think the retirement will stick?
He talked about self-preservation before the fight. And then after the fight, he talked about retiring from the ring. I think for now, officially, he's retired. And will this stick? We will know when it comes 2016.
Namdi, you were ringside in Vegas. What did you think of the money man's performance?
It was a superb performance. I mean, he went into the fight with the mentality of hit and don't be hit. This man has really shown her that it's not all about getting knocked out and blood and bruise or fighting macho fight. He made it look very easy, you know. I mean, his defense was still airtight, but he got hit a couple of times. At this age, he will be 39 early part of 2016. The body's telling him it's time to let go, it's time to move away. He's got $800 million in the bank.
Namdi, let's listen in now to what Mayweather had to say at the post-match press conference.
You get to a certain level to where you can't buy nothing anymore. You know, you can't get moved by a Rolls Royce, or you can't get moved by a car. When you got everything, there's nothing else you can get moved by. And I've accomplished everything in the sport. So now it's time for me to help these young fighters break my record. I want to see my records broken. Of course, I want to be a part of it. I'm just blessed.
Namdi, we heard Mayweather say he's going to work with younger fighters. Do you think that's his plan for now, to develop younger fighters?
Well, he needs to count his money. He needs to be able to count his money first, you know. Developing his stable is one thing. He's going to travel, and then he's going to develop fighters to come and see who can fill his shoes. But it's not going to be easy. I mean, he'll be bored. He will want to be in the limelight. He will want to be there at the fights, and he will want to go back to the gym and train. So for now, he's retired. But when we go into the spring of 2016 and then look at what Manny Pacquiao will do with American, then we can then look back and say, is he really retired?
49-0 after this unanimous decision victory over Andre Berto ties the mark held by the late great heavyweight Rocky Marciano. Don't you think 50 sounds better than 49, Namdi?
50 sounds better, and 50 comes with huge money, because with 50, with 50, we're talking about a rematch with Manny Pacquiao. Mind you, the numbers are finally together now for that first one with Manny Pacquiao. He walked away with almost $300 million, you know, so can you imagine how much he will get in the second fight, the rematch? So 50-0 sounds great, and nobody can touch 50-0. Nobody can even touch 49-0. Let's be realistic here, Sonny.
Nnamdi, let's talk numbers for Berto. What were the pay-per-view numbers?
The first pay-per-view numbers was 550,000 to 600,000 pay-per-view buy, and then looked at times $80. So that is still big money. He only paid Andre Berto $4 million. The rest of the money, he will keep it because he is also the promoter. So on the back end, he gets lots of money. Guaranteed, he made $32 million on paper for Uncle Sam. But at the end of it, he goes home with a lot of more.
Nnamdi, in the build-up to the fight, you said the MGM Grand Arena might not sell out. What was the final gate?
The final gate was 13,395, but the house was full. This is a venue that holds 17,000, which means the house was papered. You know, when we say papered in the house, which means the casino gave away free tickets to high rollers and people that work in the casino. So the house was full, and then it was papered house.
At this stage, Nnamdi, where do you rate Mayweather in boxing history?
In boxing history, Sonny, I think he will be number one, and I mean it. Fans of Muhammad Ali will not be happy to hear me say this because he's walking away being the best pound-for-pound fighter of the sports, the biggest pay-per-view star, the best welterweight, a global star, Sonny. I believe it's going to be hard for us to find anybody that will come close. My number one pick, ahead of Joe Frazier, Muhammad Ali, and Andy Chavez, all those people, Floyd Money Mayweather.
You know, I face all the top guys in the sport of boxing. You know, to be in a sport for 19 years and to be world champion 18 years, I had a remarkable career. Every champion, Ali, Sugar Ray Robinson, Sugar Ray Leonard, and so many legendary champions, Larry Holmes, and the list goes on and on, that opened up the doors to pave the way for me to be where I'm at today. I'm appreciative. But these young fighters that's in the audience, they know the truth. Them fighters say, we want to be like Mayweather.
Floyd Mayweather, and our VOA listeners can follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny. And here's a Sunny Side of Sports birthday shout out for Felix Ukwe, one of my Facebook friends, who is celebrating a birthday this Friday in Warri, Nigeria. Happy birthday, Felix! I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahaeus Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
Coming up, the International Monetary Fund and other creditors refuse to cancel Zimbabwe's $10 billion debt. And next, in Uganda, a young woman taking the lead in business to help people put food on the table. But first, some music. Here is Jose Camilione of Uganda with Badalisha.
Peto ya rusini na yo kidole. Nilikupenda ba baby sorry. Utamba Hata mwingine don't you worry. Patoto tumeza tunawoti yale. Tulipanga mina we mileli. Lakini nini 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 unanichanganya. Maisha wote wawili tulipanga. Shida ni nyingi hatuja kusana. Hainge kuwa hivyo unapenda upendi. Mupezi tuwachane na hivyo hivyo. Unanifize sana ninateseka. Nani moyoni mimi na uma.
I got to go. Kangende. I need to go. Sita weka.
Nimekumilia sana. Utaki change na wano meshinba. Kubadilisha.
I got to go. Kangupowe. I need to go. Mukwano.
Unanifize sana. Ninateseka. Nani moyoni mimi na uma.
Kangene, anechiko, sita weza.
Nime kumilia sana, utaki chenji na wano meshinwa kubadilisha.
Kakatiko, kangupuwe, anechiko, mkwano zunga.
Kini bati, unayependa sana, popata lipo, haitweza beli. Atakula za mutu, anakula za kesipo.
Nipe changu na mini kupe chako, kamu nipeni hilo nifako. We got a lot of issues to say to. Pamuja twende mseto.
Love me baby, I will love you back. Scratch my back, I will scratch your back. Not this way, unapenda upendi. Unaniumiza sana, ninateseka. Nani moyoni mimi na uma.
I got to go, kangende. I need to go, sita weza.
Nimekumilia sana, utaki change. Na wano meshinwa kubadilisha.
I got to go, kangupowe. I need to go, mukwano.
Nauma.
I got to go, kangende. I need to go, sita
weza. Sana, utaki chenji na wano meshinwa kubadilisha.
I got to go, kangupowe. I need to go, mukwano nunya.
Tuliamua tuwe together. Mimi na wewe tuwe forever. Listen now, girl. Every woman for a man. Love me, I love you, but I not what I want. Girl, it's another tune that missing over a tune. And this one, girl. Girl, never worry about it. Every time you come up, I'm gonna sweet it. This one, bad man. I'm your music. I'm
your
Jose Camilione of Uganda with Badilisha.
Well, Zimbabwe's finance minister says he has given up on convincing the International Monetary Fund and other creditors to cancel the country's $10 billion debt. Now he says the country may use its natural resources in an effort to pay back the money. Sebastian Myofu has more from Harare.
Patrick Chinamasa, Zimbabwe's finance minister, said the government held what he called frank and candid talks with the IMF regarding the country's economy.
And if we are meeting as economists, we will agree the fundamentals are not in good shape. The end game is to reach an accommodation with creditors in order to clear our arrears. I believe that we have resources which, if leveraged, can also help to get us out of our situation.
The arrears in question are debts totaling $10 billion that Zimbabwe owes to organizations such as the IMF, the World Bank, and the African Development Bank, all of which have stopped lending to the country. The resources are Zimbabwe's rich deposits of gold, diamonds, and other minerals, which, if properly exploited, could pump millions of dollars into the economy and help Zimbabwe pay back its debt. President Robert Mugabe's government blames the current situation on Western sanctions imposed on him and ruling party officials following reports of human rights abuses and election rigging in 2002. Domenico Fanica, an assistant director with IMF's African Development, says debt repayment is key to reviving the country's economy.
And the problem for Zimbabwe is that the country cannot access financing, either from international financial institutions or bilateral trade. Why? Because it does not serve its debt. In other words, the country is heavily into arrears. So it's impossible for the country to borrow.
Last year, Chinamasa appealed in vain to the African Development Bank to write off $500 million of Zimbabwe's debt, hoping the IMF and the World Bank would do the same. Now it seems he's planning to ride the country's resources back to financial health. He said Zimbabwe is sending a team to Brussels, Berlin, and Paris to present a plan to pay the debts if the creditors will give Zimbabwe time to breathe. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
In Uganda, a young woman is taking the lead in business to help people put food on the table. Mariam is a young entrepreneur who is keen on promoting domestic and international tourism and says it's a venture that boosts the country's economy and benefits its citizens. Reporter Esther Gitwe has the story.
Miriam Chasimire runs the Kagera Safaris Tour and Travel Company. She says her goal is to ensure every tourist dollar spent in Uganda benefits the locals.
It's not just any, you know, another tour company. It's a tour company that is committed to seeing the tourism dollar come down to the communities so that the communities also are able to benefit.
This young entrepreneur wants to see more Ugandans visiting different regions of the country where they can learn from each other and also appreciate the beauty within their borders.
It just moves money from one area to another. And right now, starting last year, the Uganda Tourism Board has been working on what we call domestic tourism. And every time I have my friends and take them around on a tour, they're always like, is this Uganda? I'm like, yeah, this is your country.
She wonders why Ugandans would spend money to tour faraway parts of the world when there's so much beauty at home as well as neighboring East African countries.
When a Ugandan moves from Kampala and moves, let's say, to Kabale, That's also transfer of money from Kampala to Kabale. But then they get to appreciate their country and they're more patriotic actually after that. They're like, we didn't know we had these beautiful places. We didn't know we had these beautiful islands on Lake Victoria.
And after visiting the US, Miriam says she has a new vision for Uganda and sees her native country from a different perspective.
And seeing the impression that people have of Uganda, that's something I want to change. That people would come to Uganda and experience the true and real Uganda as opposed to what they read in the news or what they watch on TV that is sometimes not a representative of what Uganda is.
For those who would like to visit Uganda, she has some suggestions for sites that will take your breath away.
You have to go to Jinja and see Source of the Nile. That is a must see. You have to go to Makshon Falls and look at those, you know, when the Nile is compressed into a 7-meter gorge and see how those, you know, the falls, they are very powerful. You'd want to go on a boat safari and experience the animals coming down to drink and, you know, all that. I would say go to Lake Bunyonyi, very beautiful, down in the corner with near Congo and Rwanda. That's a place you have to visit. And I would say visit Mbale, you know, look at the hills and you know, hike up the Mount Elgon.
This young entrepreneur is also involved in youth mentorship, helping them see that it is possible to start a business with available resources, no matter how limited.
Indeed, every African country is unique, from the landscape to the peoples and their diverse cultures. And what Africa needs is connectivity from one country to another to ensure domestic and intra-Africa tourism thrives.
That's VOA's Esther Gitwe reporting from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Hayes Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Peter Hundley, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Somalia, long torn by clan rivalries, stricken by drought and resulting famine, and attacks by a militant extremist group, has made many strides since completing its political transition in 2012. In a nation once synonymous with chaos, there are now signs of improved security and economic growth. Throughout the process, the United States has stood with the Somali people, providing security, governance, and humanitarian assistance to help strengthen democratic institutions and improve stability. Recognizing Somalia's progress, and as a sign of our nation's deepening relationship with it, the U.S. mission to Somalia began operations on September 8th. It is based within the United States Embassy in Nairobi, Kenya, and will be headed by a chargé d'affaires until President Obama appoints and the Senate confirms the next U.S. ambassador. It's a critical step towards normalizing the U.S.-Somalia bilateral relationship, since our recognition of the federal government of Somalia on January 13th, as announced by Secretary of State John Kerry on May 5th during his historic visit to Mogadishu. Since our embassy closed in 1991 amid the country's then-growing instability, the United States conducted diplomacy on Somalia affairs based out of Nairobi. Over the past 5 years, U.S. officials began to travel more frequently into Somalia to conduct official business. When security conditions permit, it is envisioned that an embassy will be reestablished in Mogadishu. While Somalia has come far in the last 2 years, many challenges and threats remain. The Al-Qaeda-linked terrorists Al-Shabaab have been weakened but not defeated. Government services are uneven, and tens of thousands of Somalis remain displaced from their homes by violence. To keep making progress, the pivotal test for Somalia will not be securing more aid from the United States and international partners, but for its leaders to put their loyalties and differences behind them and commit to working together for the common good.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at voanews.com/editorials.
Feast with your ears on Music Time in Africa. Your connection to the best Pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This one, this one,
every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays. On Saturdays, tune in at 3:30 and 14:30 UTC, and on Sundays at 5:30 and 17:30 UTC. Or subscribe to the Encounter podcast Just go to our homepage at voanews.com and click on podcasts. Also, we love to hear from you. Send an email to encounter@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/Carol Castiel VOA. That's Encounter on VOA Africa.